Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org, and you can stream live online, or you can listen to podcasts of shows we have done in the past. And you simply do that by going to wdiy.org and looking for local programming. Look for Your Financial Choices show, and when you click on that link, you'll see all the shows we've done in the past, and you can listen at your leisure. Today is March 8th, 2017. The markets were mixed, but fairly flat as well. The Dow closing at 20,855, the NASDAQ up a bit at 5837, and the S&P down a bit at 2362. For regular listeners, you might know that last week I had the topic of listeners' tax questions. It is tax time. It's tax season. We want folks to get their tax returns done timely so that if you owe, you've got a little bit more time to save up some money to pay those taxes. And if you have a refund, get that return filed. So if you have questions, you can call in. And that was the whole show last week, basically. And tonight I'm going to open the phone lines for tax questions again, because we had so many calls last week. And recall that you can talk live on air with me or off air, whatever you are more comfortable doing. But that's what we're going to do. And in between phone calls, I do want to talk a bit about Schedule D, D as in David. For some of the items that might take a little extra attention on your part, if you have investments, capital assets, capital transactions, sales of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, that type of thing, I'm going to talk to you about some things you might have to pay attention to, some things that could kind of throw you off when you're preparing your tax return if you're not really paying attention. And for the most part, a lot of that has to do with things such as mergers, acquisitions, spinoffs, that type of thing. So we're going to talk about how that impacts the transactions you're reporting on Schedule D and what you kind of want to watch for, in particular when you're getting your 1099B as in boy brokerage sales transaction proceeds, that tax document. All right, so that's what we're going to fill in with. But if you do have questions, we are live. Lori C's in the studio. She'll take your question, or if you don't want to talk live on air, she'll write it down and bring it into the studio with me. If you do want to talk live on air, we'll just put the call through and you can talk. But we want to make sure you've turned down your radio, because there's a bit of a delay and sometimes people get confused. So we don't want to talk and be confused when we're talking. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I do typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can also email questions to yourfinancialchoices.com. You heard me mention at the top of the show the website wdiy.org. I also want to mention another show that I was affiliated with that's on the website that I really enjoyed doing. It's a new feature we're doing as part of Lehigh Valley Discourse, which typically airs Thursday evenings at from 6 to 7 with different programs featuring topics that are interesting to people of the Lehigh Valley. So it's called Lehigh Valley Discourse. And the segment that I am working on is called Lessons with Leaders, and we had our first airing last Thursday, I believe it was, and it was an interview with Mike Gosling. Mike Gosling is the former CEO of OraSure and now has another venture that you can hear more about on that interview, Lessons with Leaders with Mike Gosling. And you find that by going to WDIY.org. Again, go to local programming, click on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and it pops right up there on that page. I really enjoyed doing it. Mike was a great guest. He's done a lot for the Lehigh Valley, and I feel like it's a way to help recognize these leaders that we have locally and who have chosen to stay here locally and help our community. So that's Lehigh Valley Discourse, and that podcast is available on WDIY.org under Local Public Affairs link. All right. So, folks, we are talking about taxes tonight. If you have tax questions, you're welcome to call in live or off air. And we have someone calling in already. We have Christy from Bethlehem. Christy, can you hear me?
I can.
Hi. How can I help you?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yep.
Okay. My husband passed away this past September.
Ooh.
So I'll be doing taxes for the first time since I was single.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, what do I need to include? Do I actually file his taxes in addition to my own, or I still file jointly? How does that work?
Okay, Christy, for 2016, because he passed away in September, and I'm sorry of your loss. Because he was still alive in September of 2016, you would still file a joint return for 2016 for federal, and as a resident of Pennsylvania, you can also file a joint return. Just FYI, in the past, Pennsylvania lets us file joint out of, you know, the goodness of their heart. Technically, we are separate filers, but when we're using software, you may have to go in and select to elect to file a joint return for Pennsylvania, because if you have had a spouse who has passed away, the default would be possibly to separate the return. So you want to file joint for both federal and state. Report all your income just like usual, and you would be signing as a surviving spouse. So when you put in the information, you do put in the date of death if you're doing it yourself, or your tax preparer does put in the date of death. And as a surviving spouse, you can sign the return, you can get refunds just like usual. It's a little more complicated if it's not a surviving spouse, but in this case it is. And then what I would suggest you do then is make sure you're also doing your planning for 2017, because in 2017 you will have a different filing status, which would be single if you don't have any dependent children at home. If you have dependent, you know, relatives or children at home, then you may qualify for head of household, but If you don't have dependent children at home, you're going to be single for 2017. You want to be prepared for that, because it could look very different.
Right, right. Okay, so actually it sounds simpler than I was probably making it out to be.
Yep, it's not too bad. Now, the other thing you want to pay attention to is, I'm not sure if you've talked to an attorney, if there were any assets that were in your husband's name alone, there might be certain things that you can do with those assets. But we do have an inheritance tax in Pennsylvania, and there's a Pennsylvania inheritance tax. Anything going to a spouse is zero, but sometimes Pennsylvania might still expect us, you know, to file that inheritance tax return. So you might want to check on that. If he had any assets in his name alone, you might need to probate. You might need to provide additional documentation to transfer something. And watch out for, you know, beneficiary designations. Make sure you're doing everything right if there were retirement accounts, because you're young. It looks like I have a note of your age. Yeah. So you want to just make sure you're going to do the right thing with any assets that might come to you. Okay.
Okay.
All
okay.
right. All right, Christy, thank you for calling. Have a good
thank
night.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8255. 8810. We'll be back in a minute.
And you are listening to WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And we are back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. Tonight, the topic is listeners' tax questions. And we're also going to talk about some Schedule D items I want you to pay attention to. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And you can ask questions live on air, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, give your question to Lori C. When she answers the phone, you can give it to her. She'll write it down and bring it in to the studio. Now, Christy had just called and asked a question about filing status when someone passes away. There is also something I want to caution people on paying attention to when there's another kind of change in filing status, which is when you're single and then you get married. And now you go from single to married filing joint. A couple things happen. One, you want to make sure that you also do tax planning for that so that you're ready for any changes in the tax structure when you combine two households with of income and or deductions. So you want to see how that's going to look in your numbers, make sure you plan for it and pay enough tax and that type of thing. But the other thing we just had happen right before I left was a client had married. And we filed the return showing the husband and wife, and we were told, you know, the last name of the new spouse is the name of the husband. So let's say Mr. Smith now married Miss Jones, but Miss Jones now is Mrs. Smith. So now we have Mr. and Mrs. Smith. We file a joint return. Boom, the IRS rejects the return because the Social Security number for the wife does not match the last name of the wife. So you want to make sure that if you marry, when you marry, if you change your name, you want to make sure that you notify Social Security and that they update the records to make sure they match for when we go do electronic filing. Okay, we have another call on line one. We have Mike in Allentown. Hi, Mike. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi. How can I help you?
So I have a question. I'm engaged. My fiance isn't currently working, and she has a lot of student loan debt, upwards of $100,000. If we do get married, I have a house. I have, you know, a lot of my own assets, but I'm curious as to what kind of impact that's going to be for me in tax time if I should file separately or jointly, or
well,
you know, what?
One of the things that's going to happen, Mike, first of all, just generally, there is a student loan interest deduction, but it doesn't amount to a lot of money, and sometimes people don't get it if their income is too high. So married filing joint, if the student, if your page one income is under $130,000, you still could benefit from the student loan deduction, but I think it's limited to about $2,500. So that's one thing, you could get a deduction. But the second thing that happens is you might want to take a look at what kind of student loans they are. Like, actually do an inventory. Have your fiance do an inventory of the loans, what kind of loans they are, what interest rates you're paying on the loans, because there are certain programs for paying back student loans that she could benefit, you as a couple could benefit possibly if you file separately. Now, I'm normally not ever a fan of married filing separate because it's typically always a higher tax rate than filing married filing joint. But if you are going to have hardship in trying to pay back student loans, there is a certain program, and I just off the top of my head, I just looked at this last week for someone, and off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of the program. But if you just, you know, Google student loan consolidation, federal loans, forgiveness program, it's not a forgiveness program, but what it is it's income based
Income-based, yeah. She is.
Income-based plan. And so sometimes it is better to do it if after 10 years, you know, it's like a 10-year program, though, I think.
Yeah. She is set up on that, so it would be 15% of her income. So if we filed jointly, then it would be 15% of my income.
Right, which might be higher, you know.
Yeah, it'd be a lot higher.
Right, right. So it might be that could be something where you want to file separately if you think she's always going to not be working. And then there's other programs, too, depending on if they work for like a nonprofit, and the nonprofit could be, you know, the U.S. Post Office or, you know, some hospital or something. So there are a couple other programs, but you have to understand what kind of loans you have to know.
Yeah.
Now, if she's already in it, then she might have the federal loans that qualify for it. So as I'm saying this on the air and other listeners might be listening, not all student loans qualify for the income-based repayment program. So,
If we file separately, is there any way that in the event that she does default, that they could come after my assets because we're married?
I don't know that one off the top of my head. That's a great question. And I just don't think I've had that question put to me. So, it's her debt. You didn't sign off on it. I'm not sure about that one. You know what? I bet that is something that you could find out probably on that same website. You didn't join in that program together, so I'm not sure they could. And in fact, if God forbid anything should happen, but I know that if someone passes away with student loan debt, I don't think it's the responsibility of a survivor. So my guess would be they might not be able to come after you.
Okay.
But that's a great question. I'm going to try to find that out now. Okay. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate your calling. Folks, if you have questions, phone number 610-758-8810. That's why it's so much fun doing this show because, and what people don't realize is that there are so many questions out there. There are so many iterations of every situation that a person could have that it's not always a general answer. You know, I think I mentioned this last week. I wrote an article for the PICPA CPA Journal on personal financial planning. You hear so many people talk about financial planning these days as if it could be cookie cutter. It can't be. It has to be personal because everyone's situation is different. I mean, even to the point of this kind of a question, it could depending on what Mike's income could be and what his fiance's income could be. It could depend on how much the loans are, which in this case, we knew what they were. But personal is a very key word when we're talking about any kind of financial planning or decision making that we're doing as far as our financial life. It can depend on your own circumstances. So good questions, but I love that we always learn something new. That's what makes it so exciting to work in this field. We are going to talk a bit about Schedule D as well tonight. Schedule D, D as in David. For people who have brokerage accounts, investment accounts where you might be investing in mutual funds, and I'm not talking about in your IRAs or your retirement accounts. A lot of people actually get confused with this. They think sometimes that the transactions that they generate in their retirement accounts are reported. The only thing that we have to report when we're taking in our retirement accounts is when we take a distribution. Sometimes we get a benefit when we're putting money in. That's something that we want to pay attention to if we're making a contribution to a retirement account. There's tax benefits for that. But when we're taking money out of a retirement account, there's tax consequences for that. But generally in an IRA, a 401k, when you're buying and selling in those kinds of investment accounts, we don't report those transactions. So when I'm talking about Schedule D, I'm talking about transactions that are either in an individual account or a joint account, maybe a trust account where you're buying and selling or selling in particular for Schedule D when you're selling some capital assets, which is something you've invested in to, you know, make money basically. So we're going to talk about what kind of transactions those are and some of the things I think we need to make sure you're watching out for, in particular this year, because I've seen so many more of them, but could impact you in the future. And that's the impact of mergers and acquisitions and spinoffs and even splits sometimes. So when we come back, we'll talk more about that. But of course, the topic tonight also is listeners' tax questions. The phone number, 610-758-8810.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. We are taking listeners' tax questions tonight and talking about Schedule D. But we have another caller on line one. We have John from Springtown. Hi, John. It's Lori. How can I help you?
So I made a contribution to an IRA that I have.
Yep.
And I kind of assumed that I would get, I don't know if the term is a deduction.
Yep.
Against my income for that.
Uh-huh.
But my income turned out to be too high, and I didn't get the deduction.
Yep.
And so I'm wondering, is there any way I can take advantage of that in the future? Or, you know what I mean?
Here's what happens, John. One of two things could happen. One, you could reverse it because the IRS lets us take it back out when it wasn't allowed. If we have till April, this year we have till April 18th, but typically we have till April 15th of our tax filing year to reverse what we did in the prior year. So let's pretend you made a $5,500 contribution in 2016 because you just have always done it and you get a deductible IRA contribution, but now your income's too high. If you find out when you go to do your tax returns too high, you're not getting a deduction, you can take it back out. You just let the custodian know, I'm not allowed to take it, and you take it back out. And the next year, you may or may not get a tax document saying that you took it out, but it shouldn't have any tax consequence because you took it out in time.
Right.
The second thing is you could treat it as an after-tax contribution in your IRA. So let me give you a quick scenario. Let's pretend you already had $5,000 in your, I'm going to make it 10. Let's pretend you already had $10,000 in your IRA from years in past.
Mm-hmm.
And now you just put in $5,000 as a deductible IRA. Now you find out you can't do it. I told you, so now we're up to 15. So number one, you could take it out and then you're back to your regular 10. You've taken your five out. You throw that money in the bank. Or you say, I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to treat it like an after-tax contribution. Now you actually have cost basis in your IRA. So now you have an IRA that's worth $15,000 with a cost basis of five. Let's pretend the next year, let's pretend you're 60 and you decide to take the whole thing out. Well, now when you take out your $15,000, you're only going to pay tax on the 10 plus, any earnings that you had. But that five that was your after tax would come out tax free.
Right.
So that's a second thing. A third thing is there's something called the backdoor Roth IRA. And if this really, to me, I only even think about if I have a client who has no other IRA money. So if someone has no other IRA money and you put money in after tax basis, you could take it out and put it into a Roth.
Right.
And it's kind of like a dollar for dollar almost. But when you start mixing IRA money with after tax and backdoor Roth, it doesn't work. It's almost too complicated for me to explain right now on air. So I would say your best option would be either to just pull it back out and your income might be low enough to do a Roth IRA. So I say if you can't do a deductible IRA, but you don't need the money, I would take the money and put it in a Roth IRA, and then that grows tax-free.
Right. Okay, so if I don't do that, though, and I just leave it in and treat it as a, what did you say?
After tax. It's after tax. It mucks up the reporting later in your life.
Yeah, I'll have to remember, you know, when I retire.
Well, you can track it on a form 8606. The IRS has a form called an 8606, and I recommend that if anyone has after-tax basis, that they keep that form 8606 updated every year. But again, if you don't get the after-tax contribution, I would personally pull it out and put it into a Roth.
Okay.
Because it's tax-free then. Because if you left the after-tax basis in the IRA, the earnings on that will be taxable. Whereas if you pull it out and put it in the Roth, those earnings will be tax-free.
No, but there is also a Roth. To convert it to a Roth, there are also income requirements, right?
Well,
like my income could still be too high for that?
Well, in this case, we're not converting it. You actually would take it out and recharacterize it and put it into a Roth IRA. A conversion is a different animal. So at this point, you've caught it in time. So taking it out and putting it into a Roth. The other nice thing, John, is that you can always take your original contribution back out. So let's pretend you kept the $5,000 after tax in that IRA. Remember, I said it was $15,000, and you let that go on for a few years, and now you say, well, I want to take my five back out. Guess what? Mm-hmm. At this point, it's in an IRA. You don't get to choose to take out your five. It's going to come out pro rata. So now if you took out five, it's going to be times 5,000 over 15,000, only one third is going to come out tax free. The rest of your IRA would be taxable. Whereas if you have it in a Roth, you can take out that original contribution of 5,000 without a problem.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I'm so glad I called.
Okay. Thanks
Thank
for calling.
Much.
Have a good night. Bye
bye.
Love the questions, and it can get complicated. And a lot of times, what worries me the most sometimes is when people don't know what questions to ask. Sometimes you don't realize. And as I say at the end of every show, and I love reminding people of this, it's better to be proactive than reactive. So take care of these things. Think about these things ahead of time. And in John's case, that happens often where people are used to making their regular contribution and they've done it for years, their deductible IRA contribution, and all of a sudden, whoops, time has passed and you're making a lot more money than you thought you were, or you forgot, you didn't realize the implications until all of a sudden your software tells you, whoops, you're not entitled to do it. But it's nice that the IRS gives us until April 15th to correct it. And it's usually doable. That's another reason why, folks, we want you to do your tax return early enough so that if there's any little hiccups like this, you still have time to fix them or correct them and take care of them. One of the things that John had mentioned, too, is there is something called a conversion, IRA conversion, where you convert your IRA monies to a Roth. And if you do that, you pay the tax currently. At one time, years ago, there was a limit on the income of people who would be eligible to do those conversions. But they took away that income limitation several years ago. And now anybody can convert any amount of IRA money that they want into a Roth. You just have to be ready to pay the income taxes. But the beauty there as well is you can also change your mind about that. You can change your mind about a conversion. So let's pretend you converted $100,000 of an IRA to a Roth in March of 2016. And let's say the market has, now this isn't the case, but let's pretend the market has crashed now and you think, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have converted that. Well, you actually have until the extension due date of your 2016 return to change your mind about that conversion. And you don't have to change your mind about the whole thing. You can change your mind about part of it. So I had a client once that had done a conversion, and then when we saw the rest of his income put him over a particular threshold, and that threshold would have caused him to pay more in Medicare premiums. So what we did is we just recharacterized a piece of the conversion, reversed it. There's different verbiage there. We reversed it to bring his income back below the level that would impact his Medicare premiums. So these are all the little, you know, things you need to know. Folks, if you have questions, love the questions, by the way. Phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 59 degrees under fair skies. Tonight, clear, lows around 35. Thursday, sunny skies, highs around 55. Friday, a rain-snow mix is likely with the highs around 39 degrees. And Saturday, the sun returns with highs only around 29 degrees. The time now is 6:32. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. Folks, the show tonight, listeners' tax questions and Schedule D if I get to it. Love the questions, though, so I'm okay with that. Phone number 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with me or off air, whatever you're more comfortable with. Tonight, we certainly have had some great calls, great questions, and I love that people have gone on air to ask those questions. So it helps me to have kind of a bit of a back and forth. What I want to make sure that I do mention tonight, though, is Schedule D and why I think it needs some extra attention this year, particularly for people in the Lehigh Valley. And that's because we have some companies in the Lehigh Valley this year that in 2016 that were affected by mergers and acquisitions and spinoffs. So if you are someone who may have held National Pen stock, well, we know that BB&T acquired National Pen in a combined I think you got cash and shares. And we had First Niagara, which was purchased by KeyBank. And that also was an exchange for cash and shares. And Riverstone acquired Talon in a private buyout. So our folks who had PPL, who then got the spinoff of Talon and now had Talon stock from the year before, then got bought out by Riverstone. So we all have transactions on our Schedule D for these types of things. Air Products spun off Versum Materials. So some people who had Air Products stock got these extra shares of Versum. And what do you do with it? And how do you know what your cost basis is? So these are some of the items that you need to pay attention to when you're doing your tax return, because here's the piece you might miss. If you have your stock at a brokerage house and they had it like pre-2012, maybe you bought it through them, maybe you didn't, maybe you transferred it in, they may not have your cost basis on their books. Nowadays, what happens when we buy mutual funds and stock bonds at a brokerage firm, they're required to track our cost basis and our acquisition dates. They track our lots, our tax lots, we call them. They're all tracked now since 2012, and there were different years for that. One year it was mutual funds, the next year I think it was the equities. And that's when you look at your brokerage statement and you'll see sections that will say short-term and long-term, and they're short-term covered lots and they're short-term uncovered lots, long-term covered lots, long-term uncovered lots. What are they talking about? Covered means they were covered by the legislation that the brokerage firm has to track your cost basis. Uncovered, they didn't have to. We have now become so used to that since it's been like since 2012. We've become so used to getting our 1099 and seeing all that information there that we presume the cost basis is there. You take your tax documents to your tax preparer, or maybe you're sitting online and doing it, and you're just entering the numbers. You want to pay close attention, because if you look down the column that says cost basis, you want to make sure it doesn't say missing. So if you're putting in totals or not really looking at it, you might miss that it says missing, or it may not have been calculated properly. So you want to make sure that you are tracking that yourself, or that you have provided that information to your broker, that they can then enter it in the system and then they still track it. It still might be an uncovered lot because it was pre-2012 when they were tracking it. So it could be still uncovered, but typically your custodian of your investments can enter that cost basis in their system. So then at least you have it. Now, sometimes it'll have a little asterisk and it'll say, you know, cost basis provided by the taxpayer. And then you want to make sure that you're still keeping your records as well. But get that into the system if you haven't thought about it already. And don't forget about it. What we don't want to see is someone saying, well, it's not important, it's not a big deal. Let me think. I bought that. Oh, I think I bought that at $10 a share. You know, that's not going to fly with the IRS. So, and it's not actually as difficult as you might think to recreate it or find that information. So if you are someone who was involved in any of these kinds of transactions, make sure that you follow the thread of when you acquired whatever bank. Think about National Pen, for example, when we talk about BB&T buying National Pen. Who was National Pen before National Pen? National Pen was KMBT. Who was KMBT before KMBT? It was, I think, Keystone National Bank. So these banks have gone through such iterations, and sometimes they're ones that you may have inherited. They're ones that you may have bought on your own. You may have bought them through a broker. So you want to make sure that you have the proper cost basis on that. And don't get distracted by the new reporting rules, because the custodian may not have the right cost basis for you. The other thing you want to make sure you're watching out for on your statements, if your broker is tracking them for you, is that they have done that transaction properly on your statement. So, for example, the First Niagara acquisition by Key Bank, that was a cash and stock transaction. So typically, this could be an example of the transaction. You want to see your own accountant for it, but you got cash in that deal. And so what we might expect to see is that the cash actually ends up being all gain, and the cost basis of your old First Niagara becomes the cost basis of your new Key Bank. But the shares don't look the same. And that's because Key Bank, you know, for the Key Bank switch off, you only got a fractional share of Key Bank for what you got for the First Niagara. So if you had 1,000 shares of First Niagara, you got, you know, X amount of Key Bank. But you also got this cash deal. So the cost basis followed the of the First Niagara followed Key Bank. So these are little kind of hiccups and transactions that you just want to kind of make sure that you're doing properly on your tax return. I had a gentleman who had this First Niagara Key Bank deal, and it looks on the 1099 like he sold First Niagara. It showed no cost basis. Well, what was shown on the broker statement was actually the cash he received, which as I explained, if you understand the whole transaction, that really is going to be a capital gain piece of this transaction. But he was thinking in his mind, wait, I bought that stock years and years ago. I paid a lot of money for that. And he wanted to see that cost basis on that transaction. But that's not the case. He got cash and he got shares. The new shares took on the cost basis of the old shares. All right? Can get complicated. So I just want to alert people in particular for Schedule D transactions this year for our people who like to buy, you know, local companies, Air Products and National Pen, which, as I said, used to be like Keystone National Bank. And for all I know, it was probably something before that. And I know the First Niagara, what used to be Harleysville and used to be Citizens National Bank before it was Harleysville. So some of this stuff goes way, way back. And we know none of that was under these covered securities rules that we now have. So the custodians may not have all of that information. And also that a lot of people don't realize or understand that when you inherit stock, if a person died and you inherit an equity, it gets a step up in basis to their date of death value. Okay, so in my example, let's say grandpa died in 2010 and he had 100 shares of, you know, Air Products or something. And now I inherit that. His cost basis might have been, you know, $5 because he had it like his entire life. But then on his date of death, if it was worth $100 a share, and I inherit these shares, that would be my cost basis on those shares. And when we inherit, it is automatically long-term. So, you know, grandpa might have bought it 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, which would be short-term. Stock prices skyrockets, and now I get that benefit. That appreciation is going to be not taxable to me because I get that higher step up in basis. And you want to pay attention to that. Typically, in software that I have, I can code it inherited, and it automatically will make it long-term. So that's a little advantage there. And a lot of people don't realize about the step-up in basis or the long-term holding period. So you want to pay attention to that. So those are a few little things on Schedule D that I want people to be aware of. The other couple items is if you ever are in a DRIP plan, a dividend reinvestment plan, don't forget about those dividends are adding to your cost basis. Typically, again, you've got it through a, what is it called? Like a transfer agent, computer share, those types of organizations that do the DRIP programs. They might have that information for you. So for the period, again, pre like 2012, they might not have that cost basis in there, but chances are they still might have that information in their system and you could go grab it if it's not otherwise available. You want to make sure you're tracking that. I had a gentleman come in recently who had sold some stock that he had received, I believe, as stock awards and couldn't recall what the cost basis was. Well, stock awards are also a funny thing because a stock award is given to an employee, for example, as maybe an incentive to do a good job, stay here, and in 3 years, we're going to give you this stock. So in 2013, they say, hey, do a good job, and we're going to give you 10 shares of our company, and in 3 years, we're going to give it to you. So those 10 shares in 3 years are now worth, you know, $5,000. Well, they put that on your W-2. So when they put the value of the fair market value of those shares that they've given you on your W-2 now in 2016, that is your cost basis on those shares. Trouble is you hold on to them, you know, for 10 years and 10 years later, you don't remember that it was included on your W-2 10 years before, and you might not have kept the paperwork. You hope that maybe the company might have tracked that for you, or if you hold your tax records, you could go back and look to see if you have the documentation for those stock awards. I don't think the stock awards are spelled out on your W-2. Things like stock options might be spelled out on your W-2, but not stock awards. Maybe a pay stub You know, I never keep pay stubs, but that might be a reason to keep a pay stub because it could show up there. But sometimes the companies will may be able to help you recreate that. All right. So little Schedule D nuances. If you have questions, we still have plenty of time. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000. Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
And welcome back. Having a little conversation here in the studio. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. I'm going to mention who I have in the studio sitting here. That's Justin Cohen. He is a finance major at Temple University, and he's been joining us each week to learn. So there are college kids who are interested in finance and in radio shows. I've been told that people don't listen to the radio anymore, and the way we can prove that's not true is light up these telephone lines. But anyway, Justin and I are going to do a show in a couple weeks on the concerns and understanding of financial decisions for college students. What do they know? What are they concerned about? And so I'm looking forward to doing that with him. Jeff, we have a caller on line one. We have Richard from Pohatcong. Pohat. Hi, Richard. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, and I can't say the name of your township. I'm not from here. You know, I'm from Michigan.
I used to go up to Lake Leelanau and that area up in Traverse City.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Isn't Michigan a great state?
It's wonderful. I was thinking of those. There's a couple areas with the dunes.
Yep.
And things like that. And it'd certainly be worth another trip.
Yep. It's one of the friendliest states. And I think it's because we have all that water around us. You got to be in a good mood with all that water around you.
They had ponds up and down the shoreline. You could go in there and just try to catch frogs or whatever. The day would go away.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's lovely. So, Richard, how can I help you tonight?
Well, you mentioned two words. I haven't braced myself, actually, for taking out my 1099s and that type of stuff. But I'm going to bite the bullet, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But you did mention cost basis, and that got me, got the gray cells moving a little bit.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about an income property situation, which, you know, had variable depreciation,
uh-huh.
I guess it would be, used on over the period of time as the amount of space kind of fluctuated.
Right.
And I was just wondering if when it comes time to if a property is sold,
uh-huh.
and you have used it, a part of it as put your income, the rental income that you've received on
uh-huh.
your tax forms.
Yep.
But is there a kind of a another checkpoint that you have to go through with the IRS, either state or federal level?
Well, let me ask you, was your rental property, was any of it personal? Because I kind of was getting the feel. Some of it was personal. Okay. So is it a principal residence as well?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. So what happened many years ago, first of all, today, the rules are if you have a principal residence and you sell it and you're single and you have a gain of $250,000 or less, it's not taxable. If you're married, filing joint, it's $500,000. So that's principal residence rules if you owned and lived in it two out of the last 5 years. Back in the day, if you had a home that was a principal residence, maybe you turned it into a rental, then you could report the rental income, take depreciation on the building, and then if you sold it, there may have been some type of allocation to whether it was principal residence or not and would qualify for that exclusion. And I believe if it was done within a certain period of time, you could still get an exclusion. What happens now, if at any time your principal residence was also used for for rental use, there is a calculation you have to go through. And I don't know if you've used software, but the beautiful thing about software is that it can do a lot of these calculations for you. But real quick, just let me tell you, I had a gentleman who had a rental property, had rented it for years, actually had losses on it every year that he couldn't use because his income was too high. So those losses were suspended. We call those passive losses, and they were suspended. And if he were to have sold the rental property, upon selling it, all those passive losses are freed up and he could have taken those losses on his tax return. But he didn't sell the rental property. He turned it into a principal residence. Now, using it as a principal residence, those losses continue to be suspended until he eventually sells it later. And then we have to look at what that calculation would be. So there is definitely some complicated, I would say, computations that have to be done. But if you have always kept track of it, Richard, where you have your depreciation schedules, you have your accumulated depreciation, you know what the percentages were, then I think it can go through those certain calculations. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head here. I actually had to do an Excel spreadsheet for this kind of calculation, if I'm remembering right. So I'm not going to be able to tell you the answer like off the top of my head here, because I think it does take just a lot of extra attention. But as long as you keep all those records, make sure you carry them forward, you at least will have the bones for what you have to do.
Well, that sounds excellent, and it might even be in the year of the sale or the tax year of the sale or whatever, even if you're maybe using tax software, you might take the services of a tax preparer
to make
sure that everything is covered.
Exactly.
And the powers that be are the accounts are squared.
Right, exactly. So, and it's going to help if you've kept all those records as far as the depreciation, accumulated depreciation, and everything. Okay?
All right,
great, Richard.
Thank you very much,
Lori. Thank you. Have a good night. Thanks for calling. Folks, if you have questions, I probably have time for one more. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You know, it's funny because I am going through my head right now as to Richard's question. I did have someone who had a principal residence. They turned it into a rental property. And why I had to do an Excel spreadsheet is because they actually had a loss on the property, I believe. So as a principal residence, if you sell a principal residence and have a loss, that's a personal loss and there's no deduction. If we had figured the gain on the sale of the rental property, it appeared to be a gain. So, Richard, I don't know if you're still listening because it's all coming back to me. So if I had done just the sale of the rental property, so the principal residence had become a rental property, because they actually, you know, had a divorce and they moved away out of the state. So they just rented it until they could sell the house. So they turned into a rental property for a few years, had a huge, what would have appeared on paper to be a huge gain, a big gain on the rental property sale. But in fact, if it was their principal residence, they would have actually had a loss. Because when we go to rent a property, we use as the cost basis for rental purposes the lower of cost or market. And at the time they turned it into a rental property, the market was much, much lower than the cost. So let's pretend they paid $1 million for their house. And then when they went to rent it, it was only worth $600,000. This was several years ago and it was California, okay? So the lower of cost or market. So then when they went to rent it, the market was $600,000. So we actually were depreciating it at a much lower value. Let's pretend they sold it at $700,000. That would appear then that they would have had a gain, when in fact they didn't really have a gain because they paid $1 million for the property. That's why these transactions can get very complicated, because the IRS will tell us how to calculate it. And in fact, the software actually could not calculate that one. I had to do an Excel spreadsheet to figure it out. But it was fun, and I like that kind of stuff. We have a call off air from Gary, it looks like, in Kutztown. He purchased stock in 2000. He knows the cost, but lost the broker's paperwork. What is the liability if audited, and can he get info from somewhere? Well, Gary, if you purchased the stock in 2000 and you purchased it through a broker, it may be, if you know what you paid for it, I don't know if you kept a copy of your certificate. If you have bank records from back in 2000, you might see that money coming out of your account. You might have statements. You might have the brokerage statements. You said you don't have the broker's paperwork. It might mean you don't have the broker's confirmation, the trade confirmation, but you might have the broker's statement. You might also have had a check that you wrote. You want to go, the other thing you could do that to recreate this would be if you have your tax returns from that period of time, if it was a stock that issued dividends, that paid dividends, you might have then in 1999 your tax return showing no dividends. And if in 2000 you show a tax return showing dividends and you could actually pinpoint, oh, the dividends were for only half a year, it's pretty much ballpark for sure that you probably bought that stock that year. So I would probably, if you have those old tax returns, print both those pages as your backup, because you said you knew the cost. So what made you know the cost? You could also go back and look up and make sure the historical, the shares you bought and the historical price of that day matches what you recall and remember. Print that off. So come up with work papers for the position that you're taking in, for the cost that you're saying. Then if you're audited, while you may not be able to provide that trade confirmation, you certainly would have provided enough evidence that common sense tells the IRS, hey, yeah, he didn't have that dividend in 1999. He had the dividend in 2000. Chances are he bought it during this period in 2000. The stock traded at, you know, 10 bucks a share. Maybe it was 10 bucks and 5 cents for part of the year and 10 bucks and 10 cents for part of the year. Ballpark around 10. Yep, good, reasonable. And I think you would be okay. So sometimes people will have stock certificates, but just because you have a stock certificate doesn't mean you actually bought that stock. The stock certificate could have come from a split. So I don't always just trust a stock certificate, but I think certainly if you have your old tax returns, that's one way to create it. So that's one of the reasons I tell people to keep your tax returns forever, because, and I hope you have them, that you can recreate this. But Gary, that's a great question. Folks, our time has come to an end. Such a fun show for me when everybody calls in. Love it. Next week, guess what? You could still call in next week. We actually do this every week. And when we're not in tax season, we still do it. And people could call in and ask questions. But next week, I'm going to talk about oddball items on tax returns, things like K-1s, foreign tax credits. We don't want you to miss your foreign tax credits. Maybe 529 contributions, coordinating your education benefits, oddball items. That's what we're going to do next year, week. And of course, listeners' tax questions as well. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. I want to thank Jeff for being here, Lori and Justin. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your
financial choices.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a good one.